This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Jane in Bath. Hello, Jane.
Oh, hello, good morning.
Morning.
I was listening to the news this morning and I heard about your manifesto pledge for education, starting from nursery upwards. Well, I run a nursery and I've just been informed by my local authority that our hourly rate is being cut by 11 pence per child per hour. We had hoped to take David Cameron's advice and give our staff a pay rise on the back of a very good Ofsted report.
Mm-hmm.
However, it now looks like I might have to make somebody redundant. So how do you... What would you say to that?
Sure. Before I come to that, Jane, only not least because you work in a nursery, I can only imagine how you and everybody else in Bath sort of shaken by the terrible... The death of that little 4-year-old. Was it Mitzi? I think her name was.
Yes. Anyway. We're just outside Bath.
You're just outside Bath. Yeah.
However, it was a dreadful thing. Yes.
Absolutely horrible. Everybody's worst nightmare. Jane, as you know, but maybe other people who are listening don't, is what we've done as a government, and it's been very much my own personal insistence, is we've expanded the entitlement for people to receive for their 3- and 4-year-olds 15 hours of free preschool support, and also extended that for the first time to 2-year-old toddlers. So 2-year-olds from the lower income families now receive a 15-hour entitlement as well. Now, the thing about exactly how much you are being provided with per hour, basically, central government gives local authorities, as you know, according to a national formula, the money which I think most people objectively assess to be adequate to provide that universal provision free to families up and down the country for 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds. And then it is for councils, of course, to pass that on. There is quite a lot of variation between councils. I don't exactly know what formula is being used locally. I can look into it and get back to you. My understanding, certainly last time I was in Bath, was that folk locally were very keen to continue with the rollout of these excellent new policies. And the wider point I'm making, Jane, since you raise it today, is that, look, even as we carry on having to make the difficult decisions to balance the books, which whoever's in power, however much Labour might deny this, whoever's in power after May will need to make further savings, I believe there is one area where we absolutely should not make savings, and that is the money that goes into the education of our children from nursery right up to 19. Now, what we did in this government was we protected, again, at my personal insistence, we protected the money going into schools. I think we need to extend that protection of the money going into, rising in line with prices, going into education from nursery to 19. So, obviously, I'm not trying to kind of somehow overlook your issue about the reduction in the per head allocation you're getting locally. I'll look into that. But in terms of what we should do as a country, I actually think protecting these new entitlements for 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds, funding it properly and actually extending it, I'd like to see it, for instance, extended to all 2-year-olds from all families, is something which is a real priority for me and the Liberal Democrats.
Yes, but it's not a good idea to extend the entitlement if you can't afford to pay for it, or
sure,
if you won't pay for it,
no,
and if we can't, and if we can't provide the service.
No, of course it's not, and we must will the means as well as the ends, which is your point. And of course that's right, and that's why I think when political parties talk about education, it's really important that you should, as you are now, say, well, hang on a minute, you know, where's the fuel in the tank? And I've been very clear that we have provided billions and billions of extra pounds of money on early years education over the last 5 years. It's one of the things I'm proudest of. I totally accept there may be decisions about how the cake is divvied up locally, which clearly in your case is unwelcome to you. I will look into that. I don't know whether that is the case. There are, as I say, there's a national kind of calculation made about how much it costs, and then it's passed on through local authorities to individual nurseries such as your own. I will look into that. But my view is we need to go further and faster. For instance, giving all 2-year-olds, regardless of what family they come from, that 15 hours of free preschool support, because the evidence is so massive that if you help children in those earliest years, even before, well, of course, you'll know this, running a nursery, before they've even hung up their coat in the first day of primary school, it's the best way to guarantee that everybody has an equal crack of the whip in life.
All right. Thank you very much for your call.
Ah!
Deputy Prime...
Thanks for joining in from the Big Apple. Is London not good enough?
London is not absolutely. London couldn't be better.
Oh,
London
is
superb.
Right.
London beats New York every time.
Here.
But
pity you're not here then.
Indeed, I am missing the city.
I just
but when
feel,
you're afforded
I just feel
the
given your mockery every time I'm not in the studio. You deserve a little bit of your own.
Well said. That's fair. When you're afforded the opportunity to follow in the wake of the maelstrom that is the London Mayor Boris Johnson, one has to agree, and all I've ever had from you is about a cup of tea in Sheffield at the railway station, so one has to put up with it.
Come,
7 minutes
come
after
back,
four,
come
by
back
the
to
way,
Sheffield,
here.
And we'll roll out the red carpet.
Oh, all right, well, OK, then we've got ourselves a deal. Just briefly, Mr Craig, before we move on to other matters, I understand it all got a little bit ugly during PMQs yesterday. The Prime Minister was being accused of being a dodgy Prime Minister surrounded by dodgy donors.
Yeah.
How appropriate was that language?
Appropriate. I mean, listen, if we were suddenly going to become thin-skinned about the language used in Prime Minister's questions, I think the place would have been emptied a long time ago. There's a lot of rough and tumble which is going on, particularly now in the run-up to an election. Look, there is actually a really serious point here, which is that, and I can't stress enough, I'm not going to be pious about this because my party's got embroiled in controversies in the past about how, you know, how donors give money. Every single party gets embroiled in it. The Conservatives this week have indulged in this kind of slightly weird and odd, what is it, fundraising ball that they have, where people can pay money to go buying shoes with Theresa May or running a marathon with Ian Duncan Smith or whatever it is. The whole thing is a bit unseemly.
Why is that weird or odd, Mr. Clegg?
Because I wouldn't want to do either. But look, I accept that's a question of personal taste. But what I'm trying to say is that we need to clean this
not
up.
Illegal.
We need to. No, I just think it's just everyone's their own taste. I just think we need to clean up party funding. You got the two larger parties now resorting to type, as they are, by the way, generally, as they lurch left and right. Labour ever more in the pockets of the trade union bosses. The Conservatives ever more in the pockets of city financiers. And I kind of think that the public is so weary of this. This keeps coming around like clockwork every few months, every few years. We had an opportunity. A couple of years ago, where for months and months, I presided over this. I asked David Laws to lead on this, and I asked Ed Miliband and David Cameron to send their own emissaries to these cross-party talks to try and sort out a cross-party funding deal. And they both pulled the plug. It was cynical. It was wrong. And I would, My challenge to both Ed Miliband and David Cameron is, yes, we can either as a political class carry on like this, and I tell you, there's only one result, which is that the public will become ever more cynical and kind of switched off by politics, or, here's the challenge, why don't they both now say that whoever is in power after May the 7th will, within 6 months, commit to a final proper cross-party deal to clean up party funding in British politics. I think that would be a real silver lining.
And what do you mean by clean up, lastly, Mr. Clegg? What does that mean, sir?
Oh, so that you have new limits on how much people donations, greater transparency, a proper kind of level playing field where you don't have this. And look, this time round, it's certainly the Conservatives are doing it. It seems to me they basically think that money can buy this election. Big money should not be able to buy elections. I spend as much time as any party leader raising money for my party, and I do it because that you can't fight elections without money, but I do wish the whole system was more transparent and we had and enjoyed greater public confidence. And look, we've had endless reports. There was a report from Sir Christopher Kelly two, 3 years ago. I didn't agree with all of it, but, you know, it was a really good basis for a cross-party agreement. And it was tantalisingly within our reach. Every party put it in their manifesto last time. I convened those talks. David Cameron, Ed Miliband, cynically, now that they're tearing strips off each other, calling each other this and that across the floor of the House of Commons, both of them basically conspired to pull the plug on those talks. It was a shameful thing to do, and they should now be called to account and commit to cleaning up party funding within months of the next general election.
Strong words, Mr. Clegg. Where do we go next?
We go to Steve in Basildon.
Good morning, Mr. Clegg.
Hello.
My question's on international aid this morning. But before I go there, you was on this programme a short while ago with a question on international aid, and you made the statement that it costs the average householder £50 a year. I'd like to correct you on that. £11 billion, which is now rising to £12, actually translates to £600 a year. Now, bearing in mind the volume of money that you're spending in my name, I would like you to justify why we're funding police stations in Nigeria when we can't fund our own police force, and so forth and so forth. Education, i.e. people being taught sexual education in other countries, and yet we haven't got enough money for our own education. Services.
What you're referring to there, of course, is the funding for Malawi, where girls are given sexual
That's
education,
right.
coils and other devices. And, of course, we've spent millions trying to root and cause, stop the causes of corruption with Nigerian police. And, in fact, a report shows it's got worse. Stay on the line, Deputy Prime Minister.
So, Steve, yeah, you're right. This comes up a lot. And, look, you know, I'll be blunt with you. You and I are not going to agree on this. Do I think it is... right that we spend 0.7%, that's what it is, 0.7% of our national wealth on helping other truly wretched individuals and communities. I'll come into a minute about the use of the money around that. But do I, as a matter of principle, given that we have vowed over many, many years that we would do so, there's an international kind of solemn declaration that we would do that in order to rebalance the extremes of wealth and poverty across the world. Do I think that's the right thing to do? Yes. In fact, more than that, I'm incredibly proud that this is the government, this coalition government, despite all the difficult sort of spending decisions we've had to make elsewhere, have delivered it. And do you know what? Look, you've come up with a couple of examples. And by the way, I think providing sex education to girls in developing countries is one of the is an incredibly good use of that money.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC. Breakfast in America here on LBC. After call, Clegg, can it get any better?
Okay. Well, good morning, everybody.
Well, you decide, I was about to say. Boris.
Good morning, everybody. This is Boris Johnson bringing you your latest edition of Ask Boris on LBC. I'm here with my trusty help meet, Mr. Nick Ferrari. For the next 30 minutes, taking your calls. It's your chance for any questions you'd like to me. I will do my best to answer. So the numbers for you to get your questions on the air are 0345 6060 973 or email boris@lbc.co.uk. Don't forget, you can also watch on the website in high definition, lbc.co.uk. Let's go to our first caller.
Let's.
Colin in Ruislip. Colin, are you still there?
I am. How are you, Boris? Okay?
I'm not too bad, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for visiting the hospital radio where I work. Radio here and in the other
room. Colin, it's you. How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Fill in the listeners, right. Mr. Mayor. What are we talking about?
Well,
here?
This is a wonderful hospital radio station.
Where?
Tillington Hospital in.
Ah.
I think I'm right in saying. Go on, Colin.
Yes, sir. You recorded a get well message for all the patients. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Haven't they suffered enough than they have
I was just thinking, I don't know about the medical efficacy of my
dear
get
God,
well
some
message.
Of these souls have
Let's
been
hope.
Through so much. Colin, we move to your question of London Mayor.
What can we do to help you this morning, Colin?
My question is, I work for a care agency and I do take a lot of people out and about. We use the Metropolitan line an awful lot. And Transport for London has got these wonderful new trains. But why do the trains fitted with these doors that can be opened independently, when the trains arrive at Uxbridge Station, the driver gets out, no matter what the weather, leaves the doors open. So you're sitting on there 15 minutes before the train departs.
And there's a freezing draft comes in. I understand. Right, well, we will get on to it immediately, Colin. I will talk to Mike Brown, the superb Managing Director of London Underground, and we will see what we can do to sort that out. I'm sure there's a very simple solution. Shut the door. We will get on to it.
Seems to have solved it.
Let's work it out. If there's any reason why we can't shut that door, and I can't see why there should be, we'll get you a full explanation.
Colin, before I let you go...
That sounds to me like the sort of problem we can crack pretty soon.
Before I let you go, what have the patients of the hospital been saying about the good wishes from Mayor Johnson?
They're very responsive, actually. One thing we did have to remind Boris when he'd done the get well message, he wasn't to say this is the Mayor of London, because we'll probably use it when he's an MP again.
Oh, I see.
That might confuse people.
That works. Boris, sorry, you, that, Go on, Colin.
Quickly, if you would.
Just quickly, one other thing about these trains. When they stop at other stations, like Harrow on the Hill, and they have a three-minute wait for signals, they still keep the doors open then. But these trains can have all the doors shut, and you just open the one. And as they're all one carriage, the draft whistles down. They're like a wind tunnel.
Right.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And Colin's actually making a very, very good point. Yes. Well, we've got the new S-Doc trains, as you know, the beautiful trains on the Metropolitan line, and other lines are coming in. They are these, like, worms. They don't have any compartments. They're so they'd be, you know, fantastic for a game of indoor cricket or whatever. You hit the ball all the way down the thing.
Kiss chase.
Yeah, whatever you wanted to do. But the difficulty is that, as Colin says, the wind whistles all the way down. So, listen, well, Colin, it's a serious point. I will get on to Mike Brown and to LU and see what we can do to keep passengers warmer and to shut the doors.
Before we go to our next call, thank you for that. Good luck with the work you do. Anyone involved in hospital radio.
They do a wonderful thing.
Seriously, it's huge. We're in New York, as you are aware, Mr. Mayor. I've no idea what the time is. But we've also asked... It's absurd. But we've also got some calls from some New Yorkers. This is the first.
You're joking. Are we being listened to in New York? Is this Sophie?
Hi, Mr. Johnson. This is Lauren Jenkins. I'm from California. I have a question for you. The last time you spoke with the Queen, what did she say?
The last time I spoke with the Queen, I think, isn't there some etiquette that you're not meant to reveal your conversation?
It's allowed at this time of the morning in Manhattan.
So what did she say? I think I'm on record, actually, as reporting the gist of what she said, which was that this was after the Olympics, and I think she wanted to know whether people had been entertained by her brilliant, her stellar performance in the opening ceremony. When you remember, she appears and then parachutes in and landed in the. Do you remember she comes? I can't remember where she landed. But she came down on a parachute.
Well, she landed in the Olympics. She landed in the Olympics. It's not that hard.
Well, that's right. That's it. The Olympics. I thought it was something.
What did you want?
She was in the Olympics. I was watching it, it wasn't her.
I know, but it was
very, very cleverly done. So you were led to believe it was her, and she did a wonderful piece of acting. You will remember with the James Bond character
and Daniel Craig, exactly right,
and some corgis and her children and stuff like that. And she wanted to know what people had thought of it, and she very innocently wanted to know whether people thought it was funny. And I said it was brilliant.
Have you not seen the Queen since then?
I don't think I have, actually. I don't think I have. I don't get to see the Queen that often, you know.
Okay.
What do you think I do? Spend my whole time going around Buckingham Palace, sort of sucking up to the monarchy and stuff.
We know why we're in Manhattan.
We're in Manhattan to advertise the wares of London. He's going unbelievably well.
We're going to talk about that.
I think we need to go to Raj in Stanmore.
Raj, the London Mayor. Go ahead, Raj.
Good morning, Boris. Good morning, Nick. I must say, it's really nice to have two blonde bombshells representing us in America. But, Boris, I've got to come back to you. A year and a half ago, I contacted you on behalf of the Stanmore Chamber of Trade and the residents of Stanmore with regards to a property that we have problems with. TfL got in touch with me.
Completely
went quiet. No one wants to know what's going on. Mate, we
need you to come back early.
This is a level crossing, you say? Yeah, there's not a level crossing. It's just a pedestrian crossing traffic lights. We've already had one serious fatality on it.
Yeah.
But they've done nothing. So I know you're representing us in America, and it's brilliant, but we need your representation here. No one's doing it.
I understand. Okay, Raj, you want the pedestrian crossing fixed in Stanmore. It's definitely our road, isn't it? I remember this issue. Let me get back to you, and I will make sure. I know that TfL will be listening to this conversation, and if there's anything we can do, we will. My recollection is that there is a difference of opinion between us and the council about this. I think the issue, but we will see what we can do to sort it out, Raj.
All right, Raj, stay on the line. Talk to one of my team. We will get you through, and we'll get all the details, and the mayor will respond. Before we go on to the next caller, who is Sophie, Mr. Mayor, I have a question of you. Do you like water cannon?
I don't like water cannon, no. I think that they may...
Are they effective?
They may, in some circumstances, be necessary.
Did you discuss them with Bill Bratton, the New York...
No, they didn't come up, actually.
This is what Commissioner Bratton had to say.
Come on.
Water cannon is not something we use in the United States. We have a...
Boris likes it. He's bought some, and he's not allowed to use them. What should he do about that?
Well, that's something you're going to have to resolve over there, but here, because of the horrific history of using water hoses, not water cannon, during the Civil Rights era of the 1960s, that's anathema that we just... that's not used or contemplating being used anywhere in America.
A horrific history, Mr.
Well,
Mayor.
Well, you know, the police in America have different tools, their resources. They have much more they use. They have weapons that we don't have. As you know, there's a very different approach to arming the police here in this city, and indeed a very, very different approach to weaponry generally.
Yeah, should every police officer in Britain have a taser?
Well, it's an entirely different question. And on that, on tasers, I think no. I think that the balance that Bernard Hogan Howe is trying to strike is probably right. I think it's not a bad idea that more squad cars should be equipped with tasers, so that when they go to some, when something is going down, they have the ability to make use of a taser if that is necessary. But I don't think I want every officer, I don't think the public would want every officer wandering around with some lethal or potentially dangerous zapper thing.
Are you ever going to shoot me with a water cannon? No, you've always promised.
You seem to have some curious sort of fixation, some strange psychiatric desire to be should be water cannon.
Acrophobia.
I'm not. You know, this is something that, as right. I say, we are looking into. The position with water cannon is that the police want them in London. They think they'd be
Home Secretary
useful.
Won't allow it.
And the question is when we're
going to... Why won't Theresa May allow them?
No, there is a process to be gone through. Yeah. She is consulting various people. And I have no doubt whatever, by the way, that were those water cannon to be necessary, and we have got them at the ready, people have been trained to use them, were they necessary, were circumstances in the vanishingly unlikely... situation where we did need to deploy. Well, again, I've no doubt that a Home Secretary would supply a licence. Sophie in Hillingdon.
Let's go to the next call, Mr. Mayor. Next caller is Sophie, I believe. Sophie, go ahead.
Sophie, where's Sophie?
Hello, Boris. Hello.
How are you?
Unfortunately, my teenage son was mugged and robbed in the street just before Christmas. The police have identified a suspect and made an arrest. Right. In the course of their investigation, they have approached TfL to try and find out this suspect's travel movements on the night of the mugging. And the detectives involved have been told that TfL will not supply that information because the offence didn't take place on a bus or on a train, and the offence
was... Is that right? That sounds extraordinary to me, Sophie. Yeah. I'm going to get onto that immediately.
Yeah.
I see absolutely no reason why we shouldn't be able to supply information that of that kind that the police need in order to be able to mount a prosecution and to vindicate the rights of your son. I'm very sorry about that. Let me find out what we can do to be useful to you. And I'm very sorry about the experience of your son. And, you know, I hope he's feeling better about things. And obviously it's no consolation to you, Sophie, or to your son, but we really are doing our best to crack down on
Sophie, we will make sure that happens, and I know the Mayor's office, because we monitor it, the Mayor's office always does take relevant action.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
One of our spokesmen, Mr. Bloom, has been an avid campaigner for flat tax, and I understand that. What we are putting in our manifesto are flatter and simpler taxes, all right? And we will do that chiefly by recognising that the biggest problem in the tax system at the moment is the fact that so many people who want to come off benefit and go to work start paying tax too early. So we will campaign for no tax on minimum wage, and yes, we want flatter, simpler taxes. But do I think we need a degree of graduation in the tax system? Yes, I do. What do you think?
Yes, I'd just like to know how it would work, because at the moment you get a personal allowance up to whatever it is, 10,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
How would the flat tax work then? Would it be similar to that? Or?
I'm not proposing a flat tax. You know, there are some countries that have done flat tax. When the Berlin Wall fell, Many of the Baltic states, for example, and other parts of Eastern Europe went for a simple flat tax system where everybody pays the same percentage of tax. And it was an idea that UKIP looked at and talked about 5 years ago. It's not an idea we're looking at and talking about at the moment. We think the most important thing is that people who are not in highly paid jobs are allowed to be better off through the tax system. And that's what we will campaign for. Longer term, I would love to see everybody, you know, paying less tax. But for the moment, it's those at the bottom that have had a really rough, tough few years with wage compression and with tax rates kicking in, frankly, far too early. All right.
Let's do a couple of emails that are coming in. Yeah. Nigel Farage just comes in from Rachel in Bexley. Boris Johnson is urging David Cameron to have a European vote next year. He says that is crucial. Would that persuade you to join a Conservative coalition? Because I read in my paper this week that you say on no terms anyway.
Boris Johnson's attitude and view towards Europe is something that is a great mystery to me. It appears to change with every week, and depending on what part of the world he's in, whether he's an EU supporter or a sceptic, I simply do not know. The idea that Mr Cameron would call a referendum earlier would, of course, mean that he would have to surrender the idea that we're going to renegotiate. Now, I've always thought this renegotiation, frankly, wasn't worth a row of beans. What I have said, Rachel, is this, that if UKIP do well in these elections on May the 7th, and if we find ourselves in a position of influence in Westminster, you know, our absolute red line for trying to help anybody to form a government would have to be that we want a referendum. At the moment, that means there's no possibility of us even talking to the Labour Party because they've turned their backs on this idea. So what we would say to Mr Cameron is, we want a referendum. Yes, we want an early referendum, but we also want it conducted on the right terms. So there would be a lot to talk about. But would I be bloody-minded and not want to try and come up with a formula that gave the British people a full, free and fair referendum? No, of course, that's exactly what I want them to have.
Last email before we go to other calls. This is from Nancy in the Lake District. I like the look of UKIP, and in fact, I like your look as well. I think you're important to British politics. Are you sick of the sneering tone the media has towards you, and why don't you do something about it?
Well, the media can be rough to everybody. This is hardly unique to UKIP. They can be rough to everybody. The one thing, Nancy, that gets me down is, you know, you'll find a member of UKIP out in the country somewhere who is insignificant in the party, who says something silly, and I've argued this with Nick Ferrari before on this programme, that makes headline news, and yet if they were Labour or Conservatives, no one would know about it. That's the one thing that I do complain about. What can I do about it? Well, really, frankly, not very much. Although, you know, I do think this. The media is changing. You know, we have radio, television, newspapers, but we also have the whole online world as well, and that's an area in which we're making great progress.
We go to other
calls,
Mr.
We go to John in Eastbourne.
Yeah, good morning, Nigel. First of all, I'd just like to say that I certainly would like to see you as the Prime Minister of my country. And you obviously come over as certainly a charismatic character compared to the other two options on offer to us. Yeah, the main reason I rang today, Labour and Tory constantly keep saying they want to build 300,000 new properties every year. And every single time I go out on the road to drive my car, I'm stuck in massive traffic jams. I think we should be discouraging our population from increasing, not sort of encouraging it, as what Tory and Labour are doing at this present time.
Well, John, you know, you raise a fair point. You know, if we take the period from 1950 until the year 2000, on average, the UK population grew annually by up to 30,000 people a year through immigration, all right?
Yeah,
if you look at the figures from last year, it was 250,000. Now, so we have got new people coming into the country in unprecedented numbers. Many of them are young people who want to get on, and naturally, because of their age, they in turn are having more children. So we have had a rocketing population over the course of the last few years, and I agree with you. I think the impact on schools, hospitals, roads and everything else is absolutely mad. And let me just give you this one statistic, John, which you can remember and go and shock people with. How about this? We have to build a new property every 7 minutes. One new property every 7 minutes in this country just to cope with immigration into Britain. That, I think, is a very sobering thought in what is now the most overcrowded country in Europe. Thank you very much for your call. Should we move on to...
Let's move on, Mr. Farage. Yes, sir.
We're going to Jeremy in Harrow.
Hello, Nigel. How are you?
Good morning. Fine, thanks.
Yeah, right. Refreshing listening to you on the radio. It makes change from what I call the plain packaged parties, like cigarettes. They get the plain stuff inside, the plain stuff there outside. Unbelievable. But here's the thing, because this is where I think we've got the future on this one. Mr. Cameron keeps talking about having this referendum and renegotiation. What possibility is there actually for him to actually represent or actually renegotiate this in view of the fact that what we have is a satrapy here? We haven't actually got a government at all. We've got a satrapy here enthralled to an unelected bureaucracy, and that's exactly what they are. They're second-rate failures. And before I finish on here, may I thank you and our UKIP MEPs from the bottom of my heart and everybody's heart for your refusing to recognise a terrorist Palestinian state. Well done.
Right. Let's just deal with the renegotiation point.
That's a good idea, Mr.
Because if we get dragged into the Palestine debate, we could be here a long time. Important though it is.
Yes,
Jeremy, Mr. Cameron, five times to my knowledge in 2012, said, I do not want to have a referendum, and I certainly don't want one on Britain's membership of the EU. He then, in early 2013, changed his tune. He did it because he feared the rise of UKIP would cut into his vote. All right, it's as simple as that. It was a cynical manoeuvre.
Yeah,
and then what he tried to do was to kick it into the long grass by saying that it would follow a lengthy renegotiation. Now, actually, quite a lot of the British public say if we have a successful renegotiation, then maybe our objections to the EU would vanish. What has become clear since then, I think, are two things. Firstly, the European Union has got bigger problems than us. There's a place on the Mediterranean called Greece, which has just elected a far-left wing government, and there's a huge battle going on there. You've also got the rise of protest movements in Italy and in Spain. So the European Union is focused on desperately trying to hold together the failing single currency project. They really haven't got much time, frankly, for us. And secondly, you know, I know these people personally, Mr. Juncker, the big bosses in Brussels, and the one thing they will not renegotiate or even discuss is the question of open borders, which is the one thing the British people would want to see in a renegotiation. So, frankly, I think Cameron's renegotiation strategy is hold below the waterline, and I've no doubt, as the election approaches, you will hear the Prime Minister sounding more sceptical than you've ever heard him before, and calling about an early referendum. The problem is, I don't really believe him, and I'm not sure the British voters do either.
Jeremy, thank you for that. Nigel Farage, we've got so many people who want to get involved. We've got to move it. Sorry, Jeremy, blame me. Yeah. Don't blame Mr. Farage.
Okay,
I have to make the call. Where do we go,
let's
Nigel
fire
Farage
on to Sheila in Leighton. Good morning, Sheila.
Hello. Hello, Nick. Hello, Nigel.
Hi.
Nigel, thank you for bringing a breath of fresh air to politics. And everybody I speak to will be voting for you.
Thank you.
Anyway, Nick, my question is, what would you do about the abuse in the care homes? And shouldn't cameras be put into those care homes? Jeremy Hunt, so he's not doing anything he's saying. You know, we've had a programme on radio lately on the LBC where whistleblowers have spoke to him and he's told them to go away. He's not interested.
Let's get to Mr. Farage. Sheila, thank you for that very question. Good question.
I think Jeremy Hunt is on the wrong end of this, and I think public opinion is so outraged by the way they've seen some of our elderly people being treated that we have to adopt, and he has to adopt, I think, a different approach to whistleblowers, because one or two of these whistleblowers have actually been proven to be right. Dreadful things have been done. On the issue of cameras, it's a difficult one, because on the one hand, you know, we don't want to live in a Big Brother state, but I think given what some of those cameras have unveiled, I think it's pretty much impossible to fight against them. So I think our care homes are going to have to live with a lot more scrutiny, because I just think this is one of the things that outrage people.
Isn't there intrusion on people's personal space there? I don't know necessarily that I want cameras on. I don't have an old father anymore, he's not with us, but my old dad in a care home, Mr. Farage, isn't that a concern?
Nick, it's a huge concern, and I totally understand what you're saying, and my natural instinct would always to be against these sort of things, but I think that the use of secret cameras by that family the other day did actually, you know, highlight something. And the other thing, of course, that could be done is there could be more spot checks on these institutions. And perhaps if people don't know the inspectors are coming, then perhaps things would be found. But if a family wants to put a camera in the room, I think it would be very difficult, given what's been unearthed, to say they can't do it, all right?
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
New York is the one of the reasons we're seeing these huge investments in London is people recognise it's a very, very safe city. They look around Europe now. Our tube network is the safest of any in Europe by international comparisons.
Fantastic.
And that matters to people who are going to bring their families over and want them to be safe.
We're in Manhattan. We're Breakfast in America. We've been asking Americans, by the way, on the streets of New York for some questions. We went out yesterday and taped one. Yeah. Let's take another question from the streets of New York.
Boris, my name is Valerie. I'm from New Jersey. Do you really get your hair cut that way?
Well, Valerie, that's a very, very kind question, interesting question. I tell you, it's better than the other question I was asked by. I was walking down the street and somebody was taking my photograph and a young woman stopped and she said, "Is that Trump?" I think she meant, "Is that Donald Trump?"
Yeah.
Yeah, well...
You're more famous and richer than Donald Trump, of course, so don't worry, more wealthy.
Exactly
so
right.
Do you have your hair cut, or does it just happen by accident?
Of course I have my hair cut.
In that fashion? They actually style it like that, do they?
Well, I might ask the same question of you.
Never mind me, you're the mayor.
Enough of this personal onslaught at this time of the morning in New York.
We've got to go
to Guy in Reigate. Guy,
good morning,
how are you?
Good morning, Mr. Mayor. Talking about haircuts, if you're in the military, you should have got a haircut, but we'll leave it at that.
Sorry about that. Okay, fair enough.
Very, very quickly, you very kindly offer on the tube to all members of the forces free travel when in uniform.
Yes.
Which,
yes,
of course, is appreciated at all times. Nevertheless, some of us, when we're travelling, we would rather be in civvies, and
yes,
if we're going up to functions up in town. So would you consider allowing us to travel just in our cities, basically extending the very generous thing that you do to us to travel at all
times? It's a great thought. Guy, the reason we haven't done it is basically that we want to recognise the armed services to allow them free travel whilst in uniform. Seems to be just strike the right balance, because there are huge numbers of personnel, obviously, who could be members of the armed services one way or the other.
Sure.
Who wanted to travel around is about 100,000, must be more. 200,000 perhaps. I can't remember the exact numbers. When you tot it all up, civilians and so on combined, you'd have a very, very large number of people. I think it would be difficult to identify them. They could all obviously present their past, but I think for the convenience of the system and in order to knit together the armed services and the rest of us in the way that I would love to see, I think the rule about travelling in uniform is probably right. And I think I always hate to say no on any of these things, but I think we're going to stick with the policy that we've got, and I hope that won't be too inconvenient for your guys. One of the other things, I think to give the service to people who are in uniform, I think probably it's great, because what happens is that on the tube or wherever they are, they have a civilizing influence. People see a member of the armed forces, I think they pay them respect, and as I say, to get back to our early conversation, keep people behaving well.
All right. Quick question from me before we go to our next caller. I got in a bit of a war of words with a union official yesterday who falsely accused me of being a wife beater.
I saw that. It was extraordinary.
Yes, yeah, it was. But at the heart of it is the importance of safety of people on London Underground at a potential strike over a man who is reported to have failed a breath test.
I think the whole thing is very, very bizarre. This is a situation in which a driver, as I understand it, or a member of staff, has failed two random breath tests, and it is perfectly obvious that you cannot turn up to work on our system to drive trains and so on having failed a breath test and having failed alcohol tests. Now, what then happened, of course, was a ballot for strike action in which only 42% of people voted, 42% of the 1,225 people voted, and I think only 24% overall voted yes, 18% voted no, so it was very, very close. You had a tiny number of people voting for...
How do we allow a great city
strike,
like
and
London?
It is absolutely bonkers. It is mad. And this strike could never happen under the proposals that we are bringing forward to put in a ballot threshold.
Bringing forward or implementing? Which is it, Mr. Mayor?
Well, as you know, these have been announced by Patrick McLaughlin and the Conservatives as measures that we would bring in after the election, and they're entirely right. It's been difficult to do this in the last few years, as much as I have wanted to, and you've heard me bang on about this many, many times. We haven't been able to get coalition government support for one reason or another, and now is the time to go ahead and do this. This is absolutely mad. 1,225 members balloted. Only 299 people voted for this thing. 221 actually voted no. And we are having a strike because a guy failed two random breath tests. It is bonkers. It is potty. It is nuts. We should not tolerate it in a great city like London. And we need a change to those ballot laws. It is absolutely intolerable.
Where should we go?
Can we go to Dave in Romford, please? Sorry to get worked up. But,
not at all. No, well said. Dave, go ahead. You're through to the London Mayor. What's your question?
Good morning, boys. I just asked the Mayor's views on implementing the no jaywalking law that they have in America. Because driving around London, the pedestrians have no respect for the roads. They're on a par with a cyclist, really.
Well, Dave, obviously everybody has to pay due care and attention to the roads and road safety. I don't think I want to see a no jaywalking law of the kind they have in America. We're a land in America says it's the land of the free. Well, because we're basically a home of liberty. People should be able to cross the road, you know, looking both ways and paying due care and attention. But I do not want to see a situation in which you can be shot for jaywalking or whatever. That does not strike me as being a healthy balance. A healthy balance between the rights of the individual and the good of society. So,
somebody drives Boris around London. The pedestrians cause complete chaos. They don't look. They don't cross on the pelican crossings or the zebra crossings. They don't cross at lights, and they cause a lot of accidents, especially young.
Now you're making there's a very good point. I think in this, which is there's been a change in society, and I think what is going wrong, if I may say, I'm perfectly in favour. I think pedestrians have rights. Pedestrians. I want a London where people walk more and people use the roads in all sorts of ways. But I think the worry I have is that pedestrians are now crossing the roads with their earphones in the whole time and endlessly on their looking at their iPhones or their mobiles, texting, and not paying attention to that is what I see. Now, I both drive around London, Dave, and I cycle a lot around London, and I, of course, obviously I walk around. But as a cyclist, people drift off into the carriageway whilst looking at their mobile phones, and that is the risk I see, Dave. I don't know whether you agree with this, but that is what I think is driving. What you do is you get over to people that they have got to concentrate on what they are doing. As it happens, Dave, all the figures show that we are seeing a reduction in pedestrian KSIs. The roads in London, people have been killed or seriously injured. Yeah. The roads in London have got markedly safer over the last 10 years.
So are you talking about
pedestrians on their mobile phones.
They shouldn't be on their mobile phones.
No, what they shouldn't be doing is texting or whatever.
I'm not allowed to text as I walk on the streets of London.
And what they do, I'm telling you, because I watch this as a cyclist, what they then do is they drift absent-mindedly off the pavement onto the road.
Have cattle prods or something that stops them. What would you do?
What I'm going to do is use this very excellent public service called LBC. It's a wonderful thing. It's called radio. And explain that I, as mayor, don't think it's a good idea for people so much to be on their gizmos whilst
drifting on the streets.
No, I don't mind them texting on the streets. I don't want them texting in the middle of the carriageway with Dave in Romford and me on my bicycle trying to get past because it is dangerous. That's the point I'm making.
But I also
want to reassure Dave by saying that actually, KSIs are well down and continue to come down, and that's I think a tribute to the work of
from the streets of London to the streets of New York. Let's take another call, another question even, that we taped earlier from New York.
Hi Boris, my name's Patrick. I just want to know, what are they putting in the sandwiches at Buckingham's Palace?
The last sandwich you had at Buckingham.
Do you not notice the incredible fact? Look, we've had two questions from American listeners. Your many, many millions of Americans.
Yeah, we went out and found them.
And what do they want to know about? They want to know about the Queen. They want to know whether I had a conversation with the Queen. They wanted to know about the sandwiches in Buckingham Palace. What does it show you? That though they deep down, in a primal way, they regret that fundamental schism of 1776. And they wish that we were one single Commonwealth of English-speaking peoples again, united.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
There is no upside. The words of a woman whose mother recently went into care. Throughout 2015, I'll be looking at a subject that's breaking hearts and bank accounts across the UK.
It was then when he said to me, "This is torture," and I put my hand down his back and I could feel where the hoist was digging into his back.
I'll get some of the people whose job it is to plan and deliver social care in one room and ask them why in 21st century Britain this is happening.
There was a patient opposite my dad who had Parkinson's, got out of his bed to go on a wander, fell flat on his face. The nurse was actually standing at the glass sheet looking at him and walked off the opposite way. I ended up getting out of my seat, going over and picking him up.
Care Minister Norman Lamb will take your calls and I want your family's stories.
Sheila Fogarty, weekday afternoons from 1, only on LBC. Leading Britain's conversation, Ken Livingstone and David Mellor, Saturday mornings from 10.
The increasing number of American politicians saying that Putin is a real threat to Western Europe.
I mean, the thing about Putin is he a serious loony tune who would actually go to war? Or is he someone who's actually basically a decent fellow, kind to animals, helps old ladies across the roads, and would just back off when it all gets tricky?
Ken Livingstone and David Mellor, Saturday mornings from 10, only on LBC. Weekend mornings from 10 on LBC. Tomorrow morning, Beverly Turner.
There's been a sort of reduction, hasn't there, in the dignity and the respect that we afford old people. You know, you used to be able to turn to an old-timer, didn't you, to explain the world. Well, now we get on Google. If we have trouble working the computer, we ask a teenager. If we're not respecting our old people enough, how are we going to give them the right sort of care that they need?
Beverly Turner, Sunday morning from 10 on LBC. On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Okay, the last time the Transport Commissioner, Sir Peter Henny, the boss of TfL, was in and taking your calls. It was November of last year, just before Christmas, and this story came up. This is what happened.
Drivers on one line, the Northern Line, will stage a 24-hour strike in a row over the dismissal of a worker. The union says the dismissal was a blatant and clear-cut case of victimisation. The RMT, Rail and Maritime Transport Union, on the southern end of Northern Line, will walk out on December 1. Sir Peter?
Yes, this is a member of staff who's dismissed for drinking on duty, and I'll be interested to see how many of his colleagues are willing to go on strike to support somebody who has broken the most fundamental safety rule on the system. And I bet there's no public support for it, and I bet you don't support it either, and I don't.
And what the hell is the union doing then, supporting someone who clearly, if he's drinking at work, should never be let near a tube train? What are the union thinking?
God knows.
Well, let's put that to the union. Steve Headley is Assistant General Secretary of the RMT Union. Why are you supporting a drunk driver?
Well, first of all, you better be very careful what you're saying, Nick, because Peter Handy's had to retract that statement. It was a blatant and outright right. And I hope this program's being recorded, because you want to apologise for that statement. He wasn't drinking at work, and he wasn't drunk.
You be very careful
what you say.
Mr. Headley, can I just make my point? I have information in front of me now that he failed, your driver, who we've not identified, has failed a breath test.
The breath test that he'd taken showed that he wasn't over the legal drink drive limit whatsoever. Let's get this very, very straight. Secondly, Peter Henry has apologised for saying that he was drinking at work. He was not.
So the London Underground have fabricated the evidence that he failed the breath test.
No, because you're just basically showing your ignorance here. The breath test for London Underground. Yeah, well, if you let me answer that. The breath test for London Underground shows up at about 10% of the drink drive limit. Now, the man in question has got diabetes, which has been proven can give a false result on a breathalyzer.
Mr. Headley, can I just clarify? We'll get into that in a second. Did he, as is reported, fail the breath test?
Well, we believe that the breath would... It's quite clear, London Underground... Listen to me.
Mr. Headley, did he fail it? Have you
stopped beating your wife?
I'm a divorced man. Right.
Well, have you stopped beating your ex-wife? Have you stopped beating your ex-wife?
Can you... I'm going to take
it's
it...
Not a it's not a yes or no answer, it. Is it?
Well,
it's not a yes or no answer.
Right, the test wasn't administered by the test.
Are you going to let me speak? Or are you just going to talk over the top of me?
I'm going to take it.
The test wasn't administered by a professional.
Mr. Headley, let me now hear your problems with the test, now that I assume he has failed. Thank you.
Have you stopped beating your wife, have you? I assume that you haven't, then.
Would you stop being offensive, Mr. Headley?
Can you stop being offensive?
I'm taking it that your colleague failed the test. Now let's hear the problems.
I'm taking it that you haven't stopped beating your ex-wife.
Goodbye, Mr. Headley. I just find that offensive. I have tried time and time and time again. I have to take it that your colleague failed. You had really interesting points to make there. Clearly you are unhappy with the test. Clearly it may have been poorly administered. Your colleague, I think, possibly suffers from diabetes. And if he is that and he's been failed, then I would be there to support him. But your vile and abusive stance means I never wish to speak to you again. And in my eyes, you have diminished the case of your colleague immeasurably. But let's see what others feel. And let's see when Sir Peter Hendy says you don't think you'll have a lot of public support. Let's see what they make of it. And for you as an Assistant General Secretary, I suggest you need some form of media training. Goodbye. Mr. Commissioner, how important is money to fight terrorism?
It's absolutely critical. We are very fortunate in New York City that the federal government has prioritized spending hundreds of millions of dollars here over the last 13, 14 years since 9/11. Money is absolutely essential.
So in the UK, Commissioner Bernard Hogan Howe, a man I know you know well, has asked for cash, and it's likely he's not going to get it. He's only going to get a small percentage. What should he say to the Prime Minister?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that if, in fact, he feels there is a need for it, that need isn't being responded to, understanding clearly that at the national level that there's so many concerns. But the issue of terrorism, as we view it here in New York City and in this country, is such that it has always received a priority both at the federal government level and at the city level in terms of funding, because the recognition that a terrorist attack, a significant terrorist attack, can have a phenomenal impact on the economy of a city, of a country. We last year had 56 million tourists visit this country, and with the dollar being as strong as it is now, we're expecting even more coming this year. A great many from England, I'm happy to say. Matter of fact, a bunch of them ran into the mayor on the subway today, and he's talking with them.
Well, we'll do as much to keep sending them through, Mr. Commissioner. What's your view of water cannon?
Water cannon is not something we use in the United States.
Boris likes it. He's bought some, and he's not allowed to use them. What should he do about that?
Well, that's something you're going to have to resolve over there. But here, because of the horrific history of using water hoses, not water cannon, during the civil rights era of the 1960s, that's anathema that that's not used or contemplating being used anywhere in America.
Sir Bernard Hogan Howe recently was rebuked for using police powers to snoop on journalists and news desk records. Is that something you would ever condone?
In our country, that the limits on our ability to surveil are very significantly restricted by our Bill of Rights, various amendments. And it's something that in this city, for example, we have various agreements. It's called the Handshoe Agreement, a court case settlement many years ago, back to the 1970s, that significantly limit what the police can do relative to surveillance. It's controlled very significantly with authorizations and warrants. I'm not familiar enough with the intimacy of your situation, but...
But it would be concerned, would it, if police were to be found snooping at what happened to be a political editor's mobile phone?
Well, it would depend on the nature of, is that whether they're in the media or not, if they're basically involved in some type of crime, that would not preclude us from, in the course of the investigation of that crime, getting the appropriate warrants. But in general, the idea of spying, if you will, or snooping on the media is not something that we would engage in.
Just finally, I had Sir Bernard Hogan-Howe on my show earlier this week and caused a bit of a row because I asked him if he knew the anti-terrorism hotline number for the Met. And he didn't. Say I was to put the same question to you right now, Commissioner, for the NYPD. Do you know the number?
We don't have an anti-terrorism number. We have 911. We have 311. We have TIPS hotline that
you don't have crime a counter-terrorism number as such.
We don't have a counter-terrorism number as such. And, you know, in terms of we rely on people to basically bring information through a variety of sources.
So what's NYC safe?
I'm sorry?
What is NYC safe?
That is a, if you see something, say something.
That's not counterterrorism.
It's counterterrorism in the sense of the national see something, say something campaign. That's the New York City version of that.
He's unpopular, in my view, because he has been very outspoken in the right way. There's been a spate of stories in America involving young black Americans who have been killed by policemen. And de Blasio is in a unique position of being a white mayor in New York City who is has a black wife and black children. And he talked about how he had talked to one of his black son, about the perils of being on the street and being confronted by the police. And statistically, he was quite right to do that. As a father, there's no doubt that if you are a young black youth on the streets of many New York cities, you are significantly more likely to be stopped by the police. So it's a conversation that every father would have. By airing that conversation in the light of various explosive incidents involving police, and not just in New York, but in other cities too, where they had gunned down or killed young black men in America, he made himself very unpopular, particularly in a case involving a black man in Brooklyn who was minding his own business, unarmed, selling some dodgy cigarettes. And he'd had a few cases of being convicted of this in the past. And he was put on the floor by a pack of about six or seven New York policemen. And he was put in a chokehold by one of them and choked to death on the streets of New York. And that policeman who did that has not been held to account at all. There was a grand jury verdict. He doesn't need to face proper accountability or a proper trial. In Britain, we would find that completely unthinkable. Here, it caused huge unrest in the black population. And de Blasio, who, as I say, is in a unique position of having a mixed-race family in the office of mayor of New York, I thought was bold and correct in coming out and saying, this is unacceptable. But, of course, it made him very unpopular with the police, who believed that he was taking sides against them. I didn't see it that way. I thought he was taking the appropriate action to say this kind of thing should not be happening in my city.
Who's this?
I don't have a flippin' clue. Look at that hair. I don't. No, that's the Donald Trump of England, for God's sakes.
Wouldn't you like to get away?
Oh, God, he looks very familiar.
He's very famous. Very, very famous.
I don't know.
What do you think of his style?
The hair's a little bit too long and choppy. He's got a lot of split ends. He's got to clean that up.
Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name.
Owen Wilson.
He'd love that comparison. Would you like to know who he is?
Yes, yes.
That's Boris Johnson. He's the mayor of London.
Boris, so he's a Russian descent. He doesn't have a prayer of winning.
He looks like a wildcat.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has agreed a ceasefire in the Ukraine from February the 15th. It is also reported he's agreed to start withdrawing some of the heavy artillery. I appreciate, Deputy Prime Minister, this was broken within the last 90 seconds. A quick reaction, if you would.
My quick reaction is, of course, any
agreement, any statement from those leaders, from President Poroshenko and President Putin, that they are going to enter into a ceasefire and withdraw troops is, of course, welcome. All I would say is we have been here before. We have had ceasefire declarations before. We've had promises of withdrawing troops. So it is incredibly important that we keep everyone's feet to the fire. We don't lower our guard, and we make sure that the promises that have been made in Minsk today, and I want to pay tribute to Chancellor Merkel. I've spoken to her on this on occasion myself. She is someone who knows more about Ukraine than any other international leader, and I think she's been absolutely formidable in the way that she's sought to bring the sides to the negotiating table. And without her, I don't think this announcement would have been made, but I'm sure she'd be the first to agree that we need to be very vigilant to make sure that words are now translated into action.
Deputy Prime Minister, we go back to call Clegg. Where are we going?
John in Islington. Hello, John.
Well, morning. Why is it that we persistently get misled by yourselves and other people about the EU exit? Recent, in the past, it was 3 million jobs in jeopardy. Now you've turned on to comparing, if we get out, comparing us to Norway, which is total nonsense. I mean, Norway is not Germany's biggest export client. Neither is it France's biggest export client. But the UK is Germany's biggest export client, and also France's biggest export client in Europe. It's a totally different situation. We'd be able to negotiate a very, very good deal, and apart from the fact we have a $55 billion deficit, but I can't understand why people like yourselves completely try and bamboozle us, and obviously we don't have the knowledge.
So, John, I'll come to my views in a minute, but I think they're pretty well known. But ask you. So what do you think? So we get out, and then what do? We sort of cut some perfectly favourable deal where we have all the rights to unfettered access to the world's largest marketplace, where we can continue to export exactly what we like, but what, without any of the stuff we don't like? Do you think we can have our cake and eat it, do you?
Well, I am a finance man, and I've been very pro-Europe, but what we have now is a behemoth of corruption, bureaucracy, and totally incompetence. But basically, that's not the point. I think the UK should realise we are in a very, very strong position to negotiate, particularly with Germany and France, who are the leading economies. They need us more than we need them.
I think
we would negotiate a very, very good deal. Okay. And also, you also come up with this nonsense about negotiating a Europe-US trade agreement. Well, I would ask you this. Common sense would tell me that the UK, as a traditional trading nation, would be able to negotiate a trade deal with the US much quicker than 20 other nation states of all different concerns and different worries. Mm. It's going to take a long, long time for Europe to have all the European countries negotiate a trade deal with all
John,
their different...
Forgive me for interrupting. I'm not sure if this is going to be very interesting radio listening. I just so totally disagree with you on every single count. I mean, it is naivety of the most dangerous variety for you to imagine, for instance, as you've just asserted, that a major superpower like the United States, or indeed China or Brazil, or the major, major economic powers, India, around the world, are suddenly going to cut a better deal with a country of 60 million people compared to the world's largest marketplace of over 500 million people. I, unlike you, have actually sat opposite chisel-faced Chinese and Russian trade negotiators in a previous life, negotiating good deals for British companies as part of EU trade negotiations. And it was quite clear to me, the idea that our country, proud though I am though of it, could somehow have the same clout with those major kind of economic gorillas and superpowers around the world than we do as part of a club of over 500 million, because I think is just totally fanciful, and there's absolutely no evidence that's the case. Secondly, just think through what you would wish for. If we were to leave the European Union, as night follows day, the Scottish people, in my view, would have another referendum to pull Scotland out of what remains of the United Kingdom. And so within a few months and years, we would have lost two unions, the Britain's place in the European Union and the Union of the United Kingdom. And then what's left for England? We are floating somewhere a little bit isolated, a bit lost, somewhat inward looking, somewhere in the mid-Atlantic. It's simply not the kind of country I want my kids to grow up in. And John, the idea that you can sort of pull out of a club and say, oh, by the way, we want to retain all the privileges, but none of the duties, I just don't think is possible.
Mr. Clegg,
right, John, your turn now. John, briefly, if you would, John, your response to the Deputy Prime Minister.
Well, I've been in international finance for 50 years,
in a quite a senior capacity. And I think you're talking total utter tosh. And I don't think you, as with you obviously have much more eloquence and speaking than I do, but I think you're talking total utter tosh because you're in a confined situation. And if you look at the country which your wife is a member of, Spain, and I lived quite a time in Spain, the EU, which is supposed to be socialist, has impoverished the whole of Greece, Spain, Portugal. And I know this. I know the Spanish people, and they hate the EU. They've gone. The poor are now impoverished, and that's the result of these ridiculous policies, which have really favoured big corporations and not the general public. Now, I think.
Let's hear from Mr. Clegg on that, Nick Clegg.
So, John, to say you and I are not going to agree, I think, to put it mildly. Look, John. Look, let me try and be a bit more emollient. Does the European Union need reform? Of course it does. Do we spend too much money on the common agricultural policy? Is it ludicrous we spend millions of pounds of taxpayers' money having MEPs migrate down to Strasbourg every? Of course. By the way, in the same way that Whitehall and Westminster, and I've been working there now for 5 years in government, is in desperate need of reform. But reform is one thing, but quitting it altogether, quitting the world's largest borderless single market where we can export, you know, everything from financial services, which you've worked in, to cars, to our great manufacturing sector, to agricultural products, upon which, yes, directly and indirectly, millions of jobs depend in this country, is, in my view, tantamount to an act of economic self-harm. And I know it's terribly fashionable amongst the Conservatives and others. Oh, why don't we blithely say, why don't we have a referendum next Tuesday? But I would just simply say to people who kind of think it's all a bit of a game, I'm not saying you believe that, John, but I think some people, in particularly in the Conservative Party, do, really be careful what you wish for, because I think we could lose our place at the top table in Europe and lose our cherished United Kingdom within a very short space of time if they don't rethink the direction of travel that they're presently on.
Let's do a couple of, or one email at least, if I may, Mr. Clegg. Wendy in Barrow says, I'm a small businesswoman. I don't know whether that means in stature or number of employees. Is the Prime Minister right to say that we need to give everyone a pay rise? Mr. Clegg.
I think clearly, as the economy recovers, given that prices are low, given that the government, and not least because of the Lib Dem flagship policy of giving people big tax cuts by raising the point at which you pay income tax, is being delivered as well. Of course, you want people to share.
So he's right.
Well, you want people to share, but where I assume Wendy would say, if she was on the line, she would say, yeah, but at the end of the day, it's my decision. It's not that of politicians. And of course, that's right. I mean, Wendy has to run her business as she sees fit. But equally, I want as many people to share in this growing economic recovery as possible, including in their pay packets.
All right, we move to other calls, Mr. Clegg. Where are we going next?
Rupert in Twickenham. Hello, Rupert.
Good morning, Nick.
Morning.
And Nick.
Hello, sir.
Hello there. Women have thankfully had the vote from about 1918. So what do you think about Labour's Pink Bus campaign, presumably to primarily encourage young girls and women to vote Labour, and led by probably the worst person to be trying to get young women's votes, Harriet Harman, who was a past supporter of the Paedophile Information Exchange?
Right. Well, look, I'm not going to certainly comment on the last bit of your, because I think she strongly contests that. But look, in terms of, do I think voters?
She was in charge of an organisation that allowed funding. Just to make that point. But on we go to the meat of the question.
But Rupert, let's go back to the Pink Bus, which was the focus of Rupert's question. I don't know. Do you know what? It's a bit like me, Rupert. Dare I ask, how old are you?
I'm in my early 60s.
Right. So. I'm assuming you, as a younger man, were quite sort of thought that snazzy sports cars in the 1970s were quite a sort of cool thing. What I'm about to say is...
Hell are we going here, Prime Minister? What on earth is this about?
Let me explain. I think it's almost as gimmicky. It's almost gimmicky and patronising as me saying, well, if I drive around in a red 1970s sports car, people of Rupert's generation, men of Rupert's generation, will suddenly vote in droves for the Liberal Democrats. It's just kind of... It's so obvious that people are much smarter than that. They're not going to suddenly be swayed by the colour of a vehicle. They do care about what politicians will do for them and their families. And I have to say, for Harriet Harman, and her team to be as kind of pious as they are about women when it's this government that corrected the injustice in the pension system against women, which Labour presided over. It was this government that has given so many women huge, on low and middle incomes, huge income tax cuts. It was this government that's delivered 15 hours of free preschool support to all 3- and 4-year-olds, to 2-year-olds, from the low-income families for the first time, tax breaks for childcare costs, free meals at lunchtime for little toddlers, which is a huge expense for families, and not only, but often for mums as well. I think the policies, you know, at the end of the day, and what you're actually going to do for people matters a lot more than the livery of your vehicle.
All right, thank you for that. A question from me. The Evening Standard's latest monthly poll has your party down to 6%. That's the worst share for 25 years. You now find yourself behind the Conservatives, Labour, Greens, UKIP. You're in fifth place. If we go back 25 years, number one was Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor.
Great song.
What the hell compares to you at this time, Mr. Clegg?
Great song, great song. A Prince song originally, of course. Just because
well,
I'm a
thank
Prince
you.
Fan.
That's of yep. huge interest to all Lib Dem supporters up and down
no,
the land.
No,
all three of them.
Look,
what do you say to the party?
Nick, these polls, they're coming and going. Clearly, we've taken a hit in the national polls, and nothing new about that. And whether it's
a hit, you're down to 6%,
well,
Mr. Clegg.
Honestly, then tomorrow there'll be one saying we're at 13. All I would say to you is that. In those places where we are out and about on people's doorsteps explaining what we've done to pull the country back from the brink, to secure the economic recovery, to deliver the balanced budget but do it fairly, to make sure that you create the right balance between a strong economy and a fair society, we actually get a very, very good hearing. And more than that, what I'm finding as I crisscross the country, as you have commented on in the past, but people respond very well to us.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
And we're going to go straight to our first caller, who this morning is Sally from Kingston. Good morning.
Good morning, Nigel. I hope you're well.
I am.
Good. No hangover.
No. Listen, Sally, I've just, you know, had the whole of January without a single alcoholic drink. How about that?
I think that's really good.
So I've
really
lost good. Weight, anyway. And I'm fit. So far away.
Good. Well, I hope you stay like that, indeed. Nigel, I know where you stand on the EU, and I'm very supportive of that because of overcrowding of our schools, prices of property, etc., etc., and minimum wage, etc. But I don't know where you stand fully on things like, would you like to get rid of the House of Lords, like I would? Trade unions, how you feel about them? Taxes, monopolies, fracking.
Oh, gosh. Well, now, look, Sally.
Lots of things.
Well, thank you. We're going to need a long time, so I will endeavour to do a quickfire. Yes, I don't want to be members of the EU, not just because of open borders and migration, but because I don't think that 75% of our laws should be made somewhere else. I think we should be made here, and that elections should really matter in Britain. And I also do rather object to the fact that it costs this country a gross contribution of nearly £55 million a day. You mentioned the House of Lords. I think this country needs electoral reform. I don't think the House of Lords is at the top of that. What I do think, Sally, is that our first-past-the-post electoral system is now bankrupt. You know, it used to work when we had two big parties and virtually nobody else, and it simply isn't working.
Could I just pop a word in there about the House of Lords? I mean, it costs a lot of money, for one. It's unelected, like the EU, at the top. And also, it's given out as favours to friends of parties. I mean, it's an elitist group. Do you want to keep this country?
I think the House of Lords has been massively devalued over the course of the last 15 years by a record number of people being put into the upper house, and as you quite rightly say, in many cases they turned out to be donors of the Labour or the Conservative or the Liberal Democrat parties, and it is too big, it is unwieldy. Yes, the House of Lords needs reform, all right? I'm in no doubt about that. I think we will move towards an elected second chamber, probably along the lines of a Senate at some point in the future. But I repeat, my priority is that we get electoral reform for the House of Commons, number one. And number two, I want us to have a form of direct democracy in this country where if we think Parliament's getting things wrong, we can call a referendum on a key subject. Now, you went on to ask me a whole list of other things. Taxes, well, look, you know...
Could I just interrupt just a little bit on taxes? Tell me, Nigel, now tell me truly.
Well, you've asked me...
Have you avoided paying tax?
Well, the tax avoidance issue is really interesting. Lord Fink said everybody avoids paying tax. Well, that clearly isn't true, because loads of people are on PAYE, and they have absolutely no choice about the tax they pay. What I would say is nobody willingly pays more tax than they have to, and that is certainly true.
Answer the question, Nigel. I know you don't pay any more tax than you want to, but
no.
Have you avoided deliberately? Have you taken measures in your whole life to avoid?
I have never avoided any tax. I don't think I've ever avoided any tax myself through any complicated measures or in. Oh no, I haven't. I haven't.
I've got
I haven't.
An accountant that's looking after your affairs.
Yes, I have an accountant that does everything. Of course I do. And particularly since I was elected to the European Parliament 16 years ago, it's an issue over which I've got to be incredibly careful. You raised a whole load of other questions. We're going to campaign for no tax on minimum wage. We're going to campaign for an end to inheritance tax, which, of course, would stop a lot of the schemes that people use to legally avoid tax or for their children to avoid tax. And, Sally... You know, a whole load of other questions, but I think for now there are lots of other people that want to speak to me, and I thank you.
And indeed, I am one of them.
Oh, Nick, hello.
Hello, sir. Yes, indeed.
Morning.
I'm over in New York.
I know.
I'm coping somehow. It's goodness knows something past 4 o'clock in the morning, but you're sounding on fine form and well done with your health kick through January. I'm glad to hear you're in fine fettle. Good luck to you, sir. Just a quickie. Is David Cameron a dodgy bloke surrounded by dodgy backers?
I think that was a word that that Ed Miliband will come to regret. Very wealthy people, and particularly those that have businesses and houses and perhaps families around the world, you know, do legally use what's available to them to avoid paying tax. Some of that is straightforward. Some of it, in the case of one or two well-known celebrities, look to be highly immoral. So I think that Ed Miliband getting onto this turf, I think this debate is a race to the bottom, and I think already... we've seen one of the national newspapers today highlighting that after Ed Miliband's father had died, the family subsequently changed the will so that the two sons wouldn't be lumbered with too, you know, in the end with too much inheritance tax. So I think the use of the word dodgy, Ed, will come to regret. What is for certain is that the Conservative Party does have enormously wealthy backers, and it goes into this general election with more money than has ever been seen before in British politics.
Shall we move to other callers, Mr. Fry?
We're going to go on, and we're going to go to Raj in Blackheath. Good morning, Raj.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Farage. I'd just like to say, I just wanted to find out what your stance was on the CO2 emissions. I believe the lady mentioned fracking, but, you know, what's actually happening out there? Because I listen to the radio and I hear a lot about hospitals and this and that, you know, but really, there's a bigger issue. And I know that Europe and America are very ahead of this. There was a Kyoto Protocol, but I don't hear anything too much about what the green issue is with you guys. I'd like to know. It would be wonderful.
I think there are lots of sensible and good things that have been done. I drove my car this week from home to Strasbourg and back. And, you know, I got 40% more miles to the gallon than I was getting with my previous car 5 years ago. That's an example of good technology, you know, reducing the amount of fossil fuels and therefore carbon dioxide emissions that we produce. So all of that is good and all of that is sensible. My problem, Raj, is this. This country produces about 1.8% of global CO2 emissions, OK?
And the cement industry is the massive issue, and I'm looking at that one.
Well, let's talk about the cement industry. Let's talk about the aluminium industry. Let's talk about the steel industry. Let's look at the industrial massacre that has taken place to British manufacturing as a result of carbon taxes. And all that has happened, Raj, is that production has been moved to India and other parts of the world, and then the products that would have been made here are shipped back to us. Nothing that we've done here with our industries has reduced CO2 emission, but at the same time, we've disadvantaged British manufacturing. So I'm all for being sensible. I would love to find renewable energies that worked, wind energy doesn't, but for the moment, I'm just making an argument that all the while India and China are mining coal on the scale that they are, let's not destroy British industry in the name of meeting a series of EU targets on CO2 emissions.
So what would UKIP do, Mr. Farage? Just one briefly, Raj, what would UKIP do with all the wind turbines if you had your say, Nigel Farage? What would you do?
End all subsidy. Why on earth we've put 12% on the electricity bill of everybody in the country, and it's rather more than that on all of our businesses, so that rich landowners can be paid vast sums of money for doing nothing, I do not know. You'll have noticed, I mean, you've been away, Nick, but this week, there's been a big high pressure sat over the United Kingdom. You know, virtually none of the wind turbines have produced anything this week. And very often, the periods of least wind are during the winter, when the demand for electricity is actually at its peak. If someone can show me, you know, that for example, solar energy is really close to being working and won't need taxpayer subsidy, I'll cheer to the rafters. But wind, I believe, has been a massive mistake, and UKIP would end all subsidy for it right away.
Quick response from you, Raj, then we must move on.
Yeah, just quickly, as far as the wind and that, that's not an area that I'm looking at. I'm talking about that. The CO2 emissions or what's happening out there. There's a couple of industries. I went to UKTI to speak to them about the cement industry because I have something I want to offer. I want to offer Britain, actually. And I'm just saying that how to speak to them about it, but they just don't get it right now. And I want to work with people. My vote obviously is going to count. Well, I want to put my vote somewhere this year. I want to make sure it goes to the right place where they're doing something and I'm going to actually be heard about what I've got to offer, whereas they don't get it. There's a lot going on out there.
Quick pitch from Nigel Farage briefly, if you would, sir.
Raj, you know, I know I've spoken to the cement industry. I've also spoken to the refining industry. If we go on taxing people and making ourselves uncompetitive, both of those businesses will lose this country, following aluminium and others that have gone in the last few years. So you know, yes, we're right to be concerned, but we must not destroy British manufacturing to meet EU targets, all right?
Who's next on the phone, Farage?
Who's next is Tony from Palmer's Green. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Nigel. A question about the flat tax. I'd be interested to know how you can say you don't support a flat tax when less than 2 years ago, well past the last election, you were very clear that UKIP wanted to bring one in.
One of our spokesmen, Mr. Bloom, has been an avid campaigner for flat tax, and I understand that. What we are putting in our manifesto are flatter and simpler taxes, all right? And we will do that chiefly by recognising that the biggest problem in the tax system at the moment is the fact that so many people who want to come off benefit and go to work start paying tax too early. So we will campaign for no tax on minimum wage, and yes, we want flatter, simpler taxes.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
It's just a massive amount of work, and my team do an incredible amount of preparation for these things. You wouldn't believe it, because we have huge numbers of businesses that want to come with us, and we have to organise meetings, we have to set up a great big event so that they can meet the kind of clients, the potential investors that they want. As you know, we've got London and Partners out there. We've got the UKTI, the Foreign Office. They love this kind of thing. I'm sure you talked to some of the diplomats and the UKTI people. You know, they will all tell you that it is vital for UK PLC that we have this sort of mission, because you know, you can knock it. You can say it's a boondoggle and a jolly, but what it does is it helps our business people to break down doors.
What have you learnt about how London and or Britain is perceived in the US from this trip?
We are doing unbelievably well in American eyes. They think we're the best, the bright spark, the best, by far the best bit in the whole European economy, a place of real zap. I think they feel that London is the kind of America of the European Union. It's the place where they want to come. It's the place where they recognise an enterprise culture, and we're very lucky in that respect. You can never be complacent. There's Berlin. Berlin's, you know, we've got an amazing tech sector in London. 500,000 people now working in that. You know, grew from virtually nowhere. When I became mayor, nobody talked about tech. It's now the biggest employer in the city. But Berlin's coming up on the rails. If Berlin can say, well, we've got cheaper rents and stuff like that. So we've got to say, no, OK, we can sort out your housing problems in London, and we'll sort out your broadband issues and all that kind of thing. And you've got to be competitive. You've got to be out there.
Ken Livingston says you've come to the wrong part of the world. Never mind America, you should be in Asia, or you should be in Brazil.
Talking
absolutely.
I don't want to get into a pointless slanging match with Ken, but you know he's totally wrong. We did big trips to China, big trips to India, and those were also very successful. But you've got to look at where the numbers are, and you've got to look where the huge opportunities are. This is the strongest economy in the world still. And by the way, I think America will continue to dominate our economic, the world economically for as long as we're alive, culturally and politically as well. I think that America's decline has been wildly exaggerated. This is overwhelmingly the biggest source of investment in London. This is overwhelmingly our single biggest export market, and there's more to do. So you've got to play. Ken's right in the sense you've got to go for the growth markets, and we've been doing that. But you've also got to capitalise on where you're strong.
You've afforded me the opportunity to have a tremendous relationship in the time you've been mayor, and I mean that genuinely. You've been very, very close, personally and professionally. A little over a year's time, you'll walk out of City Hall for the last time. What will you think?
I will be very sad. This has been unquestionably the happiest and most productive part of my professional life, and it has been an unbelievable privilege to work for London. It's not over yet. I don't want to start knowing that as I do, I want to make sure that we get in place everything that I want to see.
And, why didn't you run and, again? You'd have won
and
again.
I want to get Crossrail 2 as well. Next week we'll be talking with the Chancellor about that on Friday. There are things I want to make sure that are absolutely irreversible.
People recognise you on the streets of Manhattan. You could have had a third term.
Well, they think I'm Donald Trump, actually.
Others do know. But you could have had a third term. Why not?
Well, you know, I think there's, in politics, it's very important to recognise that, I think, if you think about all, people who stay around for more than 8 years, they do tend to, I think, you need a fresh pair of fresh challenges as a politician, and you need to be thinking about how you can do things differently. And I think it's a mistake just to outstay your welcome. I've loved the job, but you think about Blair and Thatcher and all these people who hang on. It all ends in. All political careers end in tears, one way or another, of course, and quite rightly. It would be totally wrong if it didn't. I mean, we, wretched politicians, they need to be kicked out. But the job of mayor, I always thought, was two terms max. And obviously, I'm looking forward, if I can, to get back into Parliament in May.
Yeah, I remember you coming to power, and people said, oh, you'd never run anything. They forgot. In fact, you edited magazines, you did run something. How hard is it to run London?
It's a massive job. It's an absolutely massive job. It's a massive executive job. But what I've got, and what any future mayor will have, is a most amazing team. The people I've had in City Hall on the 8th floor, and indeed throughout City Hall.
When you got there, was everybody amazing, terrific. Or did you have to get
well,
the room?
Well, it was. All organisations change over time, and yes, there's been a pretty thoroughgoing change, as you can imagine, in City Hall. But we've got some absolutely, and some people who have stayed throughout have been, completely star performers. People who were
Under Johnson, how was it difficult? How was it different?
Well, it's much smaller. The obvious point is, we've collapsed about five organisations into one. We've saved about £30 million a year in salaries and all that sort of stuff. I'm afraid there's been big economies. I believe in a lean, mean fighting force, and we've done that. But it's very, very effective. And in the Met and in TfL, you've got outstanding people doing a great job. In the Fire Brigade, Ron Dobson, you've got some superb performers for London. So that's really how, I've been very lucky to be, at the top of what is an immensely professional, well-organized series of GLA functional bodies, and they deliver fantastically well for London.
I saw you with the NYPD Commissioner, Bill Bratton, yesterday. There's clearly a genuine relationship between the two of you. Would Commissioner Bratton be the best Met Police Commissioner we'll never have?
Well, do you know, it's so funny talking to Bill. There's no question, I think, that he would like to do it. It's fantastic. You know, Bernard Hogan Howe has done a wonderful job for London, and I think...
Should we relax the rules? Maybe not for Commissioner Bratton, but going forward, do you have to be...
Well, I was born in New York. I don't know what the rules are. I don't think there's any particular rule that says that you can't have an American. I just think you've got to have the best man for the job. And my view is that Bernard was the best candidate around, and he's done a superb job.
Okay. So, lastly, that was then at City Hall. This is now. MP for Uxbridge, I'm sure, is just around.
Well, no, we can't. You know, you really. I know. Obviously, I'm going to be campaigning very hard in the next few weeks.
Quite a sizable majority,
fighting for every vote. Well, we'll see.
Then what?
Well, obviously, I've got another year, as I say, to run as mayor, and I want to. I just want to deliver all these things. The Olympic legacy, I'm incredibly proud of. That is definitely going to be great. Crossrail 2, we've got to get in the ground. All the things, the river crossings, the extension of the tube, Battersea.
I'm a great fan, I think.
Yes, you are. And you will be the number one beneficiary of that new tunnel.
But come 2016, what next for Boris Johnson?
Well, I hope very much to be, obviously, to be back in Parliament. See what happens there, to be as useful as I can. And
How do you feel every time the papers write about leadership, there you are, your name's first or second, or sometimes third.
I think...
increasingly third, it has to be said.
Third, fifth, 98th. Well, I think, you know...
You want to be leader one
no,
day.
No, 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 look.
Come out of the scrum?
Well, yeah, I think what the reality is that if you look at the polls and you look at what's happening in politics now, it's all moving very much in our direction, and that is fantastic. The last thing this country needs is Ed Miliband and Ed Balls back in charge when they drove the car off the cliff last time there. Thelma and Louise of British politics, we don't want them back in. No, I think Thelma and Louise are rather more popular, actually, than coming in. We don't want them back in. We don't want them back in government. And we're not going to get them. What I see is David Cameron winning. I think the betting markets are overwhelmingly suggesting that Dave will... they are. Look where the money's going. Look where the money's going.
Is that right?
Definitely. Okay. Don't look at the polls. Look at where the money's going. And the polls are moving in our way too. And that's great. And
so you'll be thwarted to be leader. Boris.
I will be delighted to support a Conservative government, and that's what I want to do.
But ultimately, one day, should the ball come out of the scrum?
Ultimately, one day in the dim distant future, when David Cameron relinquishes the premiership, some babe unborn will take over. But I think the vacancy is unlikely to arise.
Right. Lastly, a plane is flying over the Atlantic with all the Conservative front bench and everybody else in it, and it crashes into the sea. You're in a two-man dinghy. You're in it, and both George Osborne and David Cameron are begging for help. You can only pull one out of the briny.
I immediately plunge, dive overboard, and offer them the dinghy in the knowledge that I can swim heroically to man myself. That's what I do.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.
Britain's Conversation. Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
There is no upside. The words of a woman whose mother recently went into care. Throughout 2015, I'll be looking at a subject that's breaking hearts and bank accounts across the UK.
It's then when he said to me, "This is torture," and I put my hand down his back and I could feel where the hoist was digging into his back.
I'll get some of the people whose job it is to plan and deliver social care in one room and ask them why in 21st century Britain this is happening.
There was a patient opposite my dad who had Parkinson's, got out of his bed to go on a wander, fell flat on his face. The nurse was actually standing at the glass sheet looking at him and walked off the opposite way. I ended up getting out of my seat, going over and picking him up.
Care Minister Norman Lamb will take your calls, and I want your family's stories.
Sheila Fogarty, weekday afternoons from 1, only on LBC.